remember the old Wayne Minor housing projects down there that they finally tore down. It was some of the worst places in Kansas City. And we went right down in there and started building a children's ministry outdoors. Before that was finished, in that one location, we were ministering to over 450 kids, and we were ministering to over 800 kids across the city, all in their location. But here's what happened. Children would come, and we would ask them when we first seen them, what do you want to be when you grow up? And this is an honest truth. Some of them would say they wanted to be a pusher. They wanted to sell drugs. Others would say that they wanted to be hookers. So the young ladies, that would be their aspiration. Some of the young men would say they wanted to be pimps, because that's what they had had before them all their lives. But over the course of a few years' time, those same children would begin to, first, it would make a transition. They would come in, they say, you know, I think when I grow up, I'm going to work at McDonald's. And, you know, that's progress. And then the next thing you know, they'd be saying, I think I'd like to be a fireman or a policeman. And then some of them were saying, I'd like to be a doctor or a lawyer. Their ideas of life was changing because of the gospel. And we had a lot of fun with those kids. We had a lot of heartache with those kids. But one of the teachers of classes, she loved this story, and she would always tell it. She talked about Adam and Eve one week, and the next week she was asking the kids, what do you remember about Adam and Eve? Well, one little boy's hand went up. What do you remember? And he said, they were buck naked. That's what he remembered. That's little boys and no training. But this same little boy, after being with us for about 3 years, he's disappeared. And of course, the parents didn't care what we did. They didn't ever tell us when they moved or whatever, but he just disappeared. We didn't know what happened to him. But in that time, he had become one of the strongest little evangelists that we had. 7, 8 years old at that time. And he was always bringing kids. He was always praying with kids in the project and then bringing them to the services. And one day we decided to open up a new territory over on the south side in another project. And the day we went over there to set up, we heard somebody calling us, and it was him. And he said, how are you guys doing? I said, we're doing fine. Or how are you? You serving Jesus? And he said, well, yeah. They told me about a place where there were no more tears. They told me about a place where there was no more pain. I'll always serve Jesus. By this time, he's 9 years old. I said, are you still winning souls? And he said, yeah, you see that one over there? That guy just lived in them naked books. But now he's serving Jesus. And he said, we're telling the story here already. And we actually began to use those kids to gather kids together and tell stories at 9 years old in those projects. Now, why can't we do that among our kids? To get kids ministering to kids. And kids talking out there about what they receive as they sit in the classes and as they work together. And we're going to do it where they have their whole thing changed up every 5 to 7 minutes. They're not going to have to try to sit through a 30-minute lesson or a 30-minute message. But every 5 to 7 minutes, it's going to be worship. It's going to be this. It's going to be that. And changing, touching their lives. Now, we're going to need workers. But the good thing about the kind of program that we're putting together is these workers don't have to kill themselves. They just kind of oversee, because kids are going to be working with kids. And we're going to see people. We just need people to go down for 10 minutes at a time and come back up into the service to oversee parts of it. So think about it. But the workers that we need the most are nursery workers. We'll talk more about that at another time. But right now, our greatest need is people who will be faithful to work in the nursery. But there too, you can make a difference. And I won't take time to do that in this service, but I will talk more about that in another service. One thing I appreciate about the Spirit of God is we can come to the time of switching the service and we can have an interruption. And I'm sorry, but I probably will always look at it as an interruption. But God will let us go right back where we were. And I would ask you that in your mind and in your spirit, you go right back to where we were when the worship team stepped down, because there is something about the beauty of our Savior that we're not completely getting in this day. But that last song they sang has so much truth in it, talking about that He will do wonders among us. Church, I want you to get that. If I could take all of the time that I have to be prominent in a service or in ministry, if I could take that out, I would. Because the thing that should be prominent is Him. And that's what we want to focus on in this house. And I'm giving 3 weeks here, starting last week, this week, and next week, to maybe causing just a little bit of shift in your thinking about how you spend time with Him and how you seek Him. In this message, I'm going to touch on several things, and I'm just going to touch on them and back away because I don't have time to give a full treatment to them. But I'm hoping that I will spark something in you that will cause you to go on your own study and take a look. And if you want to really see what condition this world is in, the culture around you, study the secular writers that are telling the truth. Don't study the ones that are trying to say what it should be, but study the ones that are telling the truth. They'll give you a real idea of where this culture is. And the reason I say that is because too many Christian writers write expressing a hope that is in them rather than expressing the reality of where we are and then looking to the hope. We need to know where we are, and then we need to move from that in the hope that is in Jesus Christ. And I honestly don't think it's anything evil. I don't think it's anything wicked. I think it somewhat marketing, but that's okay too. That's not a sin. But if you really want to study this book and study the books that is necessary to find out what this book said to them when they first read it, and then look at some of the secular writers and let them tell you where we are as a nation, where we are as a culture. And it'll change the way you look at Jesus. I'm going to begin reading. Todd, the title that I'm using this morning is That I Might Gaze Upon His Beauty. I'm going to begin reading in Ephesians chapter 1, verses 18 through 21. And I want to make this a prayer this morning as we begin along with Paul. He said, I pray that the eyes of your heart might be enlightened, so that you may know what is the hope of his calling, what are the riches of the glory of his inheritance in the saints, what is the surpassing greatness of his power toward us who believe. These are in accordance with the working of the strength of his might, which he brought about in Christ Jesus when he raised him from the dead, seated at his right hand in heavenly places, far above all rule and authority and power and dominion and every name that is named, not only in this age, but also in the age to come. It's really easy to pass over an epistle like Ephesians and just think that Paul is writing to try to focus your attention on Christ only. But when you go and you look at the order of words in the original language, and I don't do that because I know Hebrew and Greek. I do that because I've got a program on my computer that lays it out. It lays the English words out as we have structured them or as we have translated them, but then it lays out the original writing, and the English words then fall in the original way that they were put. And it's awkward for our language, but it lets you know that the translators use some liberties in working with the translation. And so... I'll mention it more later on, what you will see in this if you look at it that way, but Paul talks about the eyes of our heart. Now, when you begin to think about this, and you begin to just think about it, but begin to follow it through scriptures and so forth, the things that would be related to it, you begin to see that Paul is talking about the illumination of our innermost being. And he's going further than that and really touching on a supernatural illumination. And because we all get, as we begin to look at something and perceive something, we all get some illumination inside. But he's talking about the illumination that comes from God. And it's more than physical sight. It's that in these things, your awareness becomes as brilliant as if the sun itself was shining in your innermost being. And those of you that read the Bible often and regularly, you probably come across those times where you'd be reading along, and I don't know about you, but sometimes I'm guilty of just getting my reading done, and I'd be reading along, all of a sudden something just illuminates you inside. And for me, my day is usually wrecked then, because I've got to start chasing it out, and I'll say more about that later too. But as you begin to have the heart, the part of you that charges you and breaks forth into your soul realm and starts to cause you to have compassion or whatever, you begin to realize that there's the hope of his calling. Now, this is a phrase that I really want to work with for a couple minutes, because if you take it at surface value, you must realize that when we get to the word calling, that because of us building our own visions and because of us deciding what that word actually means, that we will begin to twist that and make it a little bit less than what it is. Now, if I read that, the hope that I'm going to be a preacher one day, I totally missed it. If I read that, the hope that God's going to use me in the prophetic, I will totally miss it. If I read that, the hope that I will be able to pray for the sick and they'll recover, I totally miss it. So we need to go back to hear what they heard. And this is calling like if you and I were out hunting in the woods somewhere and I was on the trail, but somehow you had disappeared. And I would lift my voice to call to let you know where I am and to direct you back on the trail. That's what this calling is. Get that in your thinking for a moment. Just let that rest there. That we might, and hope there means pleasure. And really it's just that we would begin to embrace his instruction with pleasure, because he's constantly calling us. We'll hear one of the prophets put it this way. We hear that voice behind us saying, "This is the way, walk in it." And oh, in our red-blooded American ways, we think, well, nobody's going to tell me what to do. And we rebuke that, thinking it's the devil, when it's the Lord saying, come on now, this is my way, walk in it. If you walk in this way, this is where my manifestation can be found. This is where those things that your heart desires can be found. And he'll be directing you. And Paul is saying, I'm praying that you'll be illuminated inside so that you'll begin to anticipate his instruction with pleasure. Now, those people that have spent time looking on the unseen, and you can find that in Paul's writings as well, you know what it is to have the excitement of possibility build up inside you. Because you get excited at the prospect. And for me, one of the greatest sources of excitement in God is that he might use me. I've got all of this teaching that is clamoring to come in, telling me that I got to go through all of this self-help process so that I can offer myself to God with this wonderful human being that I am. That don't work for me. What works for me is to realize that I really am a mess, but I'm excited that he might use me. I'm excited that he might transform me. I'm excited that he might bring me forth into something that is beyond anything that I ever thought. And it goes on and talks about then the riches of the glory of his inheritance in the saints. Now, this has been largely missed in teaching, and I want to try to get it right. As we respond to his voice and his instruction, when you sense that stirring inside of you of his presence, and like in worship this morning, when there's something that's just coming from deep in our innermost being that we wanted to release to him, when you sense that, that's his confirmation that you are among the saints. That word saints just means the holy ones. Doesn't mean somebody that's earned through a lifetime of service, they've earned something and that we deify them and after they're gone. That's not what it means. It's those that have set themselves apart and have allowed themselves to be set apart for his use, you realize when that manifest presence touches you that he's saying, yeah, you're mine. You're mine. Isn't that amazing? That when we feel it, we know that it's him. It's his presence, his urging. That's indicative of his glory, his approval resting on you. You know, some sit and leave a service and say they were never touched. Well, let's just leave that there and figure it out, because when you sense his moving, you sense, even if it's the lightest sense of his presence, he's saying, yeah, you're one of mine. Now, all of those in this service that have sensed his presence up to this point, which I would say everyone, you share in the inheritance that was Jesus Christ's inheritance. Now think of everybody around you. Every one of them shares in his inheritance. It's not just, oh, I'm so blessed because I'm a co-heir with Christ. I get an inheritance with him. But no, even in my flawed humanity, his presence indicates that I share in what Jesus has. What does Jesus have? Resurrection power, the ability to touch lives and to release something that literally changes people. And we'll get more and more into that. But the main thing he has is peace and love and joy. And folks, I'm telling you, those things are choices, because when you're an inheritor, you have a choice of whether or not to use the inheritance. Those things are given to you in the kingdom. Now, Psalm 27, the 27th Psalm, verse 4. I want you to hear David's words here. One thing I have asked from the Lord, and that I shall seek, that I may dwell in the house of the Lord all the days of my life. Why? To behold the beauty of the Lord and to meditate in his temple. Now think of all the experiences that David had with God. David had these things of the lion and the bear when he was just a shepherd boy, and the experience of what it was of tearing them with his hand, knowing that he had done something more powerful than his normal humanity could do, but God touched him. David had the experience of taking Goliath's sword. At that time, he had to hold it with both hands and cutting off the head of the giant so he could present it to Saul. And then later on in life, he had the experience of having become such a developed warrior that he was holding that sword in one hand and his buckler in the other hand, and he killed like 3,000 guys at one time, something like that. And David had those experiences, and he said, but one thing that I ask from you is that I could look on your beauty and dwell in your house forever. Now, don't mistake this building for his house. This is a building. Don't you know that you are the temple of the Holy Spirit? God, I'm going to dwell in my own dwelling with the knowledge that I am filled. I am a container of the Holy Spirit. I can't restrain him because he's everywhere, but he's in me. In your most agitated moment, he's in you. In the moment when you feel like you're hurting the most, he's in you. When you're feeling most rejected, he's in you. And as the song said, he's not affected by anything that is going on outside in your world. He's still God, and he's in you. He don't come in parts and pieces. With all of his equipment, he's in you. David said, oh, I want to dwell on that. And while dwelling there, I want to look upon the beauty of the Lord. Now, in many cultures in the world, ours included, men, when they hear beauty, they just pass it off. Say, well, that's not for me. I don't need that. Except when they see it on a woman, then they don't pass it off. But I want to work with this for a moment. That word behold means that I mentally perceive. And when you look at, I don't care, I looked at least 7 different lexicons on this, and every one of them was talking about this being a mental thing. I perceive in my mind, and with the eye of my heart, I begin to look upon that which is, now get this, that which is agreeable, suitable, and stable. That's what the real definition of beauty. It's been translated beauty, but I look upon that which is agreeable, that which is suitable, and that which is stable, and that which has a splendor as it applies to the Lord, and that Lord there is Adonai, the one who inserts himself to confront our enemies. Now, when he asserts himself to confront our enemy, he also releases, if we will take it, into our spirits peace, joy, love, and a peace that goes beyond understanding, the love that you can never figure out. All of that he releases to the one seemed like he was in trouble until the Lord showed up. You know what? He didn't show up. He was always there, but he was there like the crouching lion. Might have been just a flicker of his tail, might have been just a batting of his eyes, but he was there. When he decides it's enough, he begins to rip and roar and tear at his prey, but the one that he's showing up on behalf of receives that peace and joy from him. Now, here's what you got to understand, is this psalm does apply to him, Adonai, but it also applies to the members of the household. And that's almost impossible to see in our teaching and in our language, but it is there. That it didn't just apply to God, but it applied to his household as a part of him. Now, we are the members of his household, right? Paul says we're the members of his body. So whatever applies to him applies to us, but David was talking about it a long time before that. So the grace and the delight that you see when you're able to gaze upon the beauty of God also applies to these people around you. That you should be able to look at them and not necessarily see their outward appearance, but you look and see where God has broken forth in them, where the beauty of God is allowed to flow forth, and you begin to touch a stableness, you begin to touch a grace, you begin to touch a lack of fear, and you know that that's God. And David said, while I'm in the house, I want to gaze on his beauty. I'm not going to pick apart those people that are a part of the household. I'm not going to look for their flaws. I'm not going to try to judge them to make me feel better. I'm going to see the beauty that is in them because Adonai has overcome some things. Now, there's some of you here, myself included, that have a long ways to go. I do. I have a long ways to go. You knew that. But hey, Adonai has done some things. He's interrupted some battles. He's caused victory when I had no right or reason to expect victory. He has interrupted and done some things. So mixed in David's delight was not just what the Lord was doing, not just what other members of the household was doing, but David was amazed at what he was doing. And you got to start to look at yourself that way, folks. Because the enemy wants to accuse you. He wants to jump up on your shoulder and start to whisper in your ear about all the things you've done wrong. God wants to show you how far you've come. Not so you focus on yourself, but so you be amazed at him. So David's cry in reality was, Lord, I don't ever want to leave this place of his blessing. Now, think of the blessing of God. Remember what we talked about. You probably don't. Let me recap just a little bit. But blessing, when you trace it through, it comes to mean one who is greater bringing himself to the level of one who is lesser. The greater is blessing the lesser. So how would the lesser bless in return? One of the songs this morning said it. Stand up in the fire. Oh, that blesses God. When you're right in the middle of the mess and you stand up and say, oh, but Adonai is on my side. There will come a time. I'm telling you, there will come a time when the righteous will shine forth like the noonday sun, and it will be in every instance. It won't be just one time all of a sudden the sun breaks out. It'll be little by little you coming into the knowledge of him. And as you do this, you begin to meditate about who he is and wonder at the fact that he wants to take you into dimensions that you never dreamed possible. And he'll do that as you begin to understand his beauty. Understand that in all situations, he's acceptable. In your most difficult time, his reaction is acceptable. Because he knows more than we know. And he sees what's going on more than we see what's going on. Now, to get to this place, we have some difficulties that we need to overcome. And these are some things I'm just going to brush by, but I hope you'll at least think about them. Take a look at them. Maybe go to the podcast and listen again and let God touch you in your thinking. But overall, in this nation, we've been taught to be logical. For me, that's a big struggle. I have to ask God to break it over and over again because for me, I've got to get it to make sense. I work in this book, and I work in the writings of other people because I need it to make sense. I need this stuff to work in my mind. And when I can say this is how it works, then I'm ready to place my faith. Am I getting on the underside of some of you? I begin to embrace what I have perceived as truth, even though my history has proven sometimes I'm wrong. I don't have this tendency as much as some, but some have the extreme tendency to embrace what their grandfather put forth as truth, even though in many other instances he had been proven wrong. Yet, we don't realize that if we start applying this to God and the understanding of God, we're forever going to be set right where we are because we can't mentally push through to his revelation. He's got to bring it and we've got to accept it. More on that in a moment. But we push on, most of us probably not even realizing that we're largely products of the historical period called the Enlightenment. Because logic and reason is what we demand. And if I can't make it line up mentally, then it must not be true. And we go on and we go on and we go on with that. What we miss is that our entire education system was built out of that. And it's also crumbling out of that. But it was built out of that. One historian, I don't have his name, but one historian called it a time of a chaos of clear ideas. Men would have ideas and they had begun to learn to write clearly about what they were thinking and put it into print. Now, I know that print started a long time before this, but it really became common to have things to read and people were learning to read in those days. So they would have an idea and they would wrap words around it, not trying the idea, not taking the idea to see if it would work with other ideas that had worked, but presenting it in written form and throwing it out there, and everybody was impressed because the education of the common people now was really starting to take hold and experience some growth. The printed page was exalted above learning in any other way. So no matter what was in print, the normal people would say, yeah, that's got to be true because this guy said it. This guy, it's very clearly stated here, and they would accept it as truth. And we in our day are almost as bad because if we see it on the internet, or if we see it on TV, or if we hear our favorite preacher preaching it, it must be true. We're not going to do any of the background. Does it remind you of a time of Moses? Hopefully I'll get to that at the end of the message. But here's what happened out of that. We developed our education system around a chaos of clear ideas. And the Christian world felt compelled to follow because they were making fun of them. Everybody was making fun. Everybody was saying that well, you don't have that clearly stated. You can't clearly say what you want to say. I read an entire book yesterday by a very highly esteemed man of a past century, some wonderful ideas in it, but as I read it, I was very aware that he was having trouble clearly saying what was in his spirit. And we have felt like if we can't get into this chaos of clear ideas, that we're somehow less educated, less able. So we've taken some of the great truths of the Bible and tried to set them apart from one another and develop a clear idea around it without seeing if it works with this other truth. Without seeing if it works with this other truth or this other truth. And we have too become a chaos of clear doctrine. Now, if you don't believe it, just go sit down and talk with some people that do a lot of doctrinal studies, and you'll find that sometimes it's like King Agrippa with Paul. Paul, much learning has made you mad. Now, we come a long ways in this, and we, as Christian apologists, if you want to put it that way, they got to where they were saying that nothing could be mystical, nothing could be supernatural. That was all over with. And so they had these fumbling efforts to explain God. Just let me throw in here, how do you explain God? They learned more and more, and they set the universe then. Yeah, it was set in order by God. It was created by God, but then God pretty much leaves it alone. And that's kind of where it has come out in a lot of mainline doctrine. But about there is where we get difficulties. Because God always breaks out of the box. And I think we're living in a day when God is breaking out of the box. How do you explain the intensity of presence that we've had here the last few weeks? It's not my efforts. I'm pretty sure it's not the worship team's efforts. Yeah, we work to work together with him, but we know we couldn't create that unless he manifests. But he's manifesting. And it's clearly part of it is mystical. Clearly part of it is beyond our, what we can do. But the thing is, we're a mess. So let me just kind of highlight a couple of those difficulties. Explain love. Think of your children. Their traits, their personality, their character. And you love those little guys. Now, I would almost bet each of you could think of another child that has a lot of those same characteristics, but you can hardly stand them. Now, be honest. Explain that. Your child does all kinds of things to get in trouble, but you have an explanation for that. But when the other child does the same thing, that parent should be jerked up before the elders and get something to happen with them because they're out of line. Think of your mate. There might be 10 men in the city that has a lot of the same characteristics, even maybe the same, you know, relatively same appearance as your husband. But you don't love them. But you love that man that you live with. Why? Explain love. Okay, let's look at truth. Explain truth. I can identify with Pilate when he says, "What is truth?" I can identify with that, but just think about it for a moment. The dictionary says it's the quality of being true. So it uses truth to define truth. The quality of being true, the belief that it is accepted, real, and true. But define truth. You see, truth as a physical thing has got to be lived. It's got to be observed. It's got to be acted out. But you just can't get a handle on it otherwise. That's why Jesus said, "I am the way. I am the truth. I am the life." God said, God is love. So love is people, persons. Truth is the activity of people and persons. It's the way that we live that has been proven through the course of time that will produce certain things in our life. And that's where truth comes from. But truth forms human beings or deforms them, one or the other. Now, I'm going somewhere with this, so stay with me. If I'm going to truly capture the beauty of Christ, only one way I can do that, and that's know the person of Jesus And I've got to look beyond what we think of as beauty to begin to grasp that, and then look back at what we think of as beauty to begin to know Him. And no, I'm not trying to confuse you. I'm trying to get you to think on a different level that is beyond the internet, beyond even the books you read, and begin to let this Spirit of God that is in you come forth and begin to break forth and touch the world around you. You know, what if all of your Christian life has been dedicated to something that is really not Jesus? And I'm not suggesting that you're unsaved. I'm just saying, what if all you ever get out of all of your labor to be right and to be a person of integrity, what if all that labor only gets you saved and nothing else? And I'm not at all questioning anyone's salvation. But if you see Him as one that can be manipulated with tears or repeated requests or the knowledge of holy writing, if you see Him as that person, you've totally missed Him. And if you've totally missed Him, then you will totally miss who you are. Because to know who you are, you must begin to know Him. Because at some point, as you mature, you're going to be able to say with all humility, if you've seen me, you've seen at least some portion of my Father. You've seen at least some portion of my Savior. You've seen some portion of the Christ, if you've seen me. Because we need to be able to talk like that. Paul said, follow me as I what? As I follow Christ. Now, if you see beauty in a worldly, cultural sense, it constantly changes. You look at the pictures of beauty from 60 years ago and the pictures of beauty now, it's a complete change. Completely. Men, women, whatever. And it changes according to media and peer pressure more than anything else. Now, some of you would say, well, I've got my own brand of beauty. Well, yeah, and it came out of some kind of peer pressure that was in back there in your life. It's some place you wanted to be accepted and decided you couldn't be, so you developed something that would shock and hope that you would be accepted because of the shock that you brought. To a lesser extent, personal taste, but majorly the media and peer pressure. And this causes us to construct an idea of beauty, and we present that idea of beauty so that we can be accepted or rejected. And when we come before God, we want to offer to Him what we've constructed. You know what His response to that is? I don't know you. I don't know you. Who are you? Think about that for a moment. You, who you are without the construction, is the one that is accepted at the throne of God. Now, is it wicked? Is it sinful to put yourself together in a way that you consider beautiful? No, it's not. But don't offer that to God. That's not who you are. Don't insist in company that you are either accepted or rejected on that basis. Now, if I were to ask everyone in this room, I would almost guarantee that there's as many descriptions of beauty in this room as there are people. Yep. Because, you know, the modern description of beauty just doesn't fit my thinking at all. Period. It just doesn't fit. I can't believe that some of these costumes can stand in front of a mirror and say, wow, you really look good. I'm thinking, what? But you know what? They're not trying to please me in that mirror. They're constructing something that will be accepted in their peers, at least they think so. Now, what it does, it looks you, if when you live in that outward form, it leaves you looking for acceptance from every earthly relationship and feeling rejection if you don't get it. And you're forgetting that Paul said, don't forget, people, you're accepted in the Beloved. You are accepted in the Beloved. Now, that's not just in the church. That's not just in God. We're all beloved of God. And folks, we need to live this out. This is important. In the church, we need to accept one another as the beloved of God, as a part of the family, as a part of the household, and give them acceptance and not rejection. very important to your future and to theirs. Now, notice this out of all this, that only through the eyes of each individual can you get a clear picture of beauty. You see, God couldn't make it all for me. I love desert mountains. And I go out in the heat of the day in the desert and climb mountains and just have a wonderful day and push rattlesnakes out of the way and the whole bit and come in just as happy as a puppy with a frisbee in the evening. Some of you would hate desert mountains. It's hot out there. You sweat. You stink. And some of you, your idea of beauty is probably inside the house in air conditioning. That's not mine. Why did God make things so different? Because he didn't want to ruin it for you. He wanted you to be able to look upon things and to behold the beauty of a creation that he made for you, and the creation that he's making for himself is you. And I would say that he probably gets a little bit irate when we start trying to run each other down. And I would say he probably also gets irate when we try to run ourselves down. Folks, this is not a self-esteem thing. This is a self-value thing, to realize that in God's eyes, I have tremendous value as me. Now, think about worship for just a minute. I don't want to get deep into this, but there's some music that they call worship that I just don't like. I don't see it. I can't get there. And I know that's probably fleshly, but I'll tell you, when I work with or along the border and these guys say, you want some of these Christian rappers to come and do the music? And I'm thinking, those two words don't go together. But they do, because I've met some guys that are really, really solid Christians that do rap music. They just don't do it when I organize it. Think about our worship service. Is it important that they do the songs that I like? That we all like? Is that possible? What's important is that we see the value in what we have. And I'll tell you, we have some valuable, valuable worshipers that are leading up here. And I'm so grateful for them. And I want to move on for that. I'm just emphasizing here. Now picture in your mind the most beautiful sunset you ever saw. Go ahead. Think about it. You can do that. See it in your mind. This morning when I got up, the sun wasn't yet up and wasn't yet rising, and it started as a little pink and back in the east, and I stood at the window and watched as it came up over the pond, and there were some clouds back there, and there wasn't a breath of air moving. The water was as clear as glass. And so I got the sunrise in the heavens and the sunrise on the pond, one of the most beautiful things I ever saw in my life. Here's what's important about that. He created that. Thousands of years ago, he set that in motion so that it would happen this morning like that. Now, that's not even the deepest part of it. I want you to get this now. Somewhere in him is all of that beauty. Somewhere in him is all of that which impresses us. Somewhere in God is all of that music that has not yet been played. Somewhere in God is all of those songs that have not yet been sung. Somewhere in God is all of those sunsets where the sun is not yet set. And we look at him and expect to understand him and be able to write books about this is who God is, and then expect people to follow that for years. I'll tell you what, if you begin a study of God and you're not completely overwhelmed by the wonder of who God is, you're not yet studying God. Because he is amazing. And if I think I can confine him and contain him in this pea brain of mine, then frankly, I don't need him. Because I've already got a little tyrant that wants to sit on that throne that I have to bring down every now and then. And that's me. Well, I want him to be enthroned on my mind and in my life, don't you? Now, him being possessor of all of this beauty makes a difference in how you look at riches. Our culture insists that success is wrapped up in bank accounts and the things that we own and lives that we live and the places we're able to go and all of that. But God insists that his success is wrapped up in coming to know him and beginning to realize that there is unexplainable riches in him, that all of that riches, that wealth, lies in humanity. All of the beauty of the creation around us will stagger you until you begin to look at the beauty that's in people. We saw some of it here yesterday, but so many people, Friday and Saturday, they came and helped to raise over $700 for missions in a yard sale. You know, we sold a lot of stuff. They sold a lot of stuff. I didn't. And I carried a few stuff in, went around and talked to a few people and left. Thank God I could leave. Thank God they didn't expect me to do it. What a wonderful group of people. They gave their time. They gave everything. There's a beauty in that because they see something far beyond that stuff. They see those dollars as eventually going to Mexico and as eventually going to North Dakota and beginning to work and do things. And by the way, continue to pray for Damon. He says he has some days where he has hardly no pain, other days where he just can hardly stand it. I don't think he's taking his pain medication. He sounds pretty clear, so maybe that's the deal. But pray for him. God's going to help him. But we just do need to continue to pray. Now, you become like what you focus on, what you gaze on. If you want proof of that, look at what molds the actions of children that are allowed to watch TV for hours and hours and hours and hours. Look at what molds their action. It's what they gaze upon. Put your child, no, don't do this, but if you put your child in company of an unruly child and they spend hours and hours and hours and hours together, somehow the child of the child that is not unruly is not does not so much affect the unruly child as it's difficult to get your child back in line when you get them back home. I don't know exactly why that works that way, but it seems to almost inevitably do so. And what you look upon, what you open yourself up to, is what you become. So as you begin to look at the things of God and begin to gaze upon them, you'll find that there's a beauty that begins to come out of you that you didn't dream was there. And as I was preparing this, I thought of some of the people that have been most impactful in my life. And if Dow Robinson was sitting here, he and I had the relationship that I would tell this story even with him sitting there, and he would think it was funny. First time I heard Dow in person, I had already heard several of the tapes and taken several of his classes by correspondence. First time I heard him in person, I was amazed. This guy, 5'2" tall. He's very much the Boston Yankee, and he'd tell you that too. His voice high and squeaky. Bald hair, bald head with a few hairs that went everywhere. But he opened his mouth and began to teach, and there something came out of him that gripped my heart. And I probably was taught more by that man than any man I'd ever met. What was the difference? The Bible kind of said it about Jesus. He had no outward form nor comeliness that you would desire him. But as he was broken, he began to shed forth and to loose something upon the earth that you cannot get away from, no matter what they say about whether Jesus is real or unreal. Nobody can get away from the fact that this one man had more impact on the earth than all other men combined. I think of another man, Ben Tipton, completely different personality, bigger man, rough. Missionary to Africa, go into Africa and take a team, and they would pray for 2 weeks saying, God, show us the miracle that will start a church here. And they would wait until God showed them a miracle waiting to happen. Then they would begin services and get that person there and let the villagers see God work a miracle. And tremendous, tremendous testimonies came out of that. But Ben, too, was a man that he'd seen too much and been too many places and was too broken down. You look at him in a crowd, you wouldn't see anything that made you want to go up and introduce yourself to him. But when he began to talk, I'm telling you, I've seen this over and over again. When he began to talk about the love of his Savior, there would literally be demonic manifestations happen all over the room. They wanted to get out of there. It was too intense for them. And but you'd see this one start to twist and turn and get agitated and head for the door. And another one over here. But there were people in the back that had been trained to work with them as they went out the door. So it didn't do them a lot of good. But the thing is, you look at him, you'd never pick him out of a crowd. But powerful, powerful man, the beauty of God would come forth. And what they release in relationship changes the way we see them. One of the greatest times of my life was right at the end of Dow's life. I got to take him on a trip where I could take care of him and make sure that he could find his way through the airports, because he was already losing that focus. And we went for the purpose of his teaching. And he sat down and began to open up the Word of God, and you wouldn't know he had ever lost a beat in his memory. He just began to pour forth. For 3 hours we sat there, and he just poured forth from his heart about the epistles and Paul and his writing. And people sat fascinated and couldn't believe that 3 hours had passed. And then after it was over, he was back to his memory sliding, not sure where he was, etc. What was happening? The beauty of holiness was leaking out from the inside of him. And folks, it's because that he spent years looking on the beauty, having no form nor comeliness that we should desire them. It's who they are and what they have become to us. Now, we've got many good-looking people in this house. I'm not saying that we don't, but when I talk to most of you, I'm not thinking of how you're accepted or how you're seen outside of these walls. I'm thinking of what a great person you are. I was thinking yesterday as I walked through here, what a great bunch of people that will give up their Saturday to see that some orphans in Chihuahua are fed a few more months. And yeah, we probably could have all pooled our money and came up with $711, but you know what? We said to the community, we're giving of our time and effort to make sure that we can do this. And guess what? We'll give that 711 and probably 10 times that before the year's over, just to see the work go forward. But we're saying to the community, we care enough to give our time to try to raise more money than we could come up with otherwise to see that the gospel spreads. And so there's a beauty in that that the church sees, or that the world sees. And when we open the doors, we need to do just what we did yesterday. We need to have people around here that are warm and accepting and kind, letting forth the beauty of God touch people as they come in. And when they say, well, I can't afford this, then, well, we'll take what you can give. Why? Because it's about letting the warmth of God come forth. It's not about that dollar figure in the end. So, true beauty, again, author unknown, but he says true beauty calls us out of ourselves and appeals to something deep within. I think I know who that is, but I won't say. So, all the beauty in the world is meant to point us toward the God who created. And I have come for years now, I've come to really appreciate what's around me. To just sit out on the lake in a boat and watch the sun go down and think, my Father set that in motion thousands of years ago and still working just like he set it up. Nothing worn out. This morning I didn't hear any gears grinding. I didn't hear a clutch slipping. I just saw the beauty of a sunrise that was amazingly beyond the normal this morning. Now, we're limited in knowing God to what we're willing to see and what we're willing to release. Now, here's where I want to go into something that's going to throw some of us for a loop, but folks, we need to do this. We need to think of this. You remember the song that we sing here, I Can Only Imagine? A large portion of our culture has thrown away imagination. Well, at least we think we have. Because we say, oh, that can't be anything good. Nothing good comes out of that. Little kids have imagination. We as adults don't. Well, let me show you how you do have imagination and you use it. Fear of the future is imagination at work. Fear of rejection is imagination at work. Worrying over what has not yet happened is imagination at work. Being stressed out because you don't think you're going to be able to perform in a certain situation is imagination at work. Letting fear overwhelm you when you're asked to speak to some people because I'm not a speaker and I'm all agitated and I can't. Forgetting that God says, just open your mouth, I'll fill it. But you got to put something in there for him to fill it with. I'll qualify that. But that's imagination at work. You see, many of us have seen imagination as contaminated, so we throw it away. But Ephesians 1 that I read as we began, open the eyes of their heart that their heart might be illuminated. That's imagination. That's what we're praying for, is that God would begin to help you to submit your imagination to the Holy Spirit. That you be able to look into his realm with the eyes of the heart, and that he will illuminate the hope that is before you. Not what you are, but what you can become. And when he shows you that, it's because he's committing to you that he'll get you there. And we need to open that up and allow God to illuminate our imagination. And because, folks, if we wait until we figure it all out, we're never going to figure out enough of God to see him at loose in the world around us, in order to see him at work. Now, if we begin to see what he wants us to see and allow ourselves to get excited about it and allow ourselves to look for that thing to begin to happen, that's the way we work our imagination. But the enemy wants to twist it. He wants you, when you see something in God, he wants you to think, well, what if that's not God? Well, what if that really wasn't God? What if that was just my mind? And stop and take yourself through a process. Do I normally think like that? No. Did God say that if I ask him for the Spirit that he would not give me a snake? Yeah. And begin to go through a process of allowing yourself to embrace what God is showing. And when you do that, there will come a time when you'll be able to say, if you've seen me, you've caught a glimpse of my Father. Why? Because you will spend your time looking upon him. When you see somebody that looks at you and there's something burning in their eyes that just disturbs you, that's because they've looked on God. That they've seen something that burns beyond the natural and beyond the normal, and they actually probably are seeing something at that moment that's beyond the normal. The 27th Psalm, verse 8, says this, when you did say, seek my face, my heart said to you, your face, O Lord, I will seek. You see, that's where we're a little bit off. Where God says, seek me, seek my face. And we say, well, first I've got to seek my healing. I've got to seek to get my mind lined out, get rid of this depression. I've got to seek this. I've got to seek that. And God says, just seek my face. Because if you start looking on me, there's something going to happen to you. If you start really seeing him, something's going to happen. Now, I want to take you into the story of Moses for a moment, just to remind you right at this point, that God told children of Israel that you all come to the mountain. I want to speak to you. And Israel told Moses that you go talk to him, because if we go, we're going to die. Now, there's something in that for every one of you. Moses, you go, because if we go, we'll die. Because fear of his presence is common in fallen humanity. Just get that settled inside of you. The Hebrew writer says that the enemy controls us through fear of death. Now, you say, well, I'm not afraid to die. That's really not what it's talking about. If I give up what my education has made me, there's going to be a dying in that. If I lay down the image I've carefully constructed to present to the world, if I stop that, there's some of me going to die in that. If I've got this persona that I want to present to the world about who I am, and I insist on hanging on to that, I'm saying to God, I'm going to live in spite of what you want. Because I've constructed this and I don't want to lay it down. And that's what was happening there. The children of Israel had become something in Egypt. And they knew that if they went into the presence of God, they were going to change like Moses had to change. And they had seen Moses go through some stuff to change. And they said, no, we're not going there. But what you're saying when you come into the presence of God, you're saying, all right, I will die and no longer exist as me. Paul said it this way. He said, it's no longer I that live, but it's Christ that lives in me. And I'll tell you what, in that you will discover the real you. Many of us don't know the real you. And let me tell you something about the real you. The real you is able. The real you is at peace. The real you is at rest. And the real you has purpose. Now, I want to back up and read out of Revelation. I'm trying to wind up here. Revelation 1, 12 through 18. I turned to see the voice that was speaking with me, and having turned, I saw seven golden lampstands. In the middle of the lampstands, one like the Son of Man, clothed in a robe reaching to the feet, girded across his breast with a golden girdle. His head and his hair were white like wool, like snow. His eyes were like a flame of fire. His feet were like burnished bronze when it's been caused to glow in a furnace. His voice was like the sound of many waters. In his right hand he held seven stars. Out of his mouth came a two-edged sword. His face was like the sun, shining in its strength. And when I saw him, I fell at his feet as a dead man. He laid his hand on me, saying, do not be afraid. I'm the first and the last, the living one. I was dead, and behold, I am alive forevermore. I have the keys to death and hell. John, if you and whoever wants to come back up here, we're going to wrap it up in a moment. Now, in your spirit, if you need to close your eyes, close your eyes. But take a moment to look on him. See, John said, he's like the Son of Man. But boy, there's something so different. And he crumpled at his feet. He's familiar, but not so much. He's the embodiment of all the promise of Israel, but there's something so convicting about him, something so holy about him, that I fell at his feet like a dead man. Now, as you make an effort to look on him, don't demand that you see a form. Just ask God to open the eyes of your heart right at this moment and look on him. When you begin to touch that presence, don't look away. You see, a lot of times we do that. We look away, but don't look away. Look on him. Let those emotions that rise up in you as that presence comes, let them have a perfect work in you. Let them begin to burn in you. Allow him to challenge you and then to conquer that which you couldn't conquer on your own. Let me tell you something. If you've got something that you've worked over and over and over again to get free from, and you haven't been able to get free from it, you're in bondage. Look on him and let him conquer that. Look on him and let him change something in you. Look on him. Don't turn away. You see, he doesn't look away. There's no shadow of turning in him. Say with the psalmist, as your soul begins to be agitated, say with the psalmist, be still, O my soul. Say with David, God, there's one thing I ask of you, and that's to give me the guts to look on your beauty, to look on the fact that you are what we need, to look on the fact that you empower us, that you enable us, and that you're going to change me. God, help me to get it in my being that this person that I've constructed to show the world is going to have to crumble. God, through it all, I'm going to find that you that can be used for the power and the glory of the kingdom. And God, there's one thing I ask, and that's to gaze on your beauty, because that one thing will change me. That one thing will rearrange me. That one thing will cause me to be something other than I am. Now, as they go through this song again, just begin to look on him. Yeah, it starts out without a whole lot of sight, just a sense of his presence. But as you do that, if you will comply, if you will give yourself to this, you're going to get a sense of his presence. Don't pull away from that. Let him burn in you. Let him do something in you. Okay, guys.